This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io. Masters of Dispute Resolution is designed to provide those involved in the mediation process with the views and insights of the most experienced and accomplished mediators in the profession. We'll share the stories of conflict and lessons learned from mediating challenging and intriguing disputes. You'll hear stories about how conflict affected the lives of those involved in the conflict and how resolution of disputes through mediation provided them with the ability to move forward unburdened by an ongoing dispute. Through our discussions, you will gain insight in how to address and overcome difficult issues and achieve more satisfying results in mediation, whether you're a mediator, attorney, or have been or contemplate being involved in mediation. Your host is Len Levy, mediator and arbiter with ADR Services, Inc., a leading alternative dispute resolution provider. Len litigated complex cases for more than 30 years and has been a mediator since 1998, joining ADR Services on its panel of neutrals in 2008. He has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. And now your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us for Season 5 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast which will add tools to your mediation toolbox. We are brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. Now, in each episode, you will hear a story about a conflict, the impact that conflict had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was reached, and lessons to be taken from that conflict and its resolution. Many of the details of the story you are about to hear have been modified to preserve the confidentiality of mediation while also conveying the essence of the conflict and its resolution. Well, today we have someone who could be the guest host on this podcast because Phyllis Chang has appeared a number of times and always interesting, always insightful. For those of you who don't know Phyllis, she has excelled at every stage of her career and was responsible for the enactment of California's Title IX law for nearly 7 years. She was director of the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, the DFEH, and which is the largest state civil rights agency in the United States. And during that time, she oversaw 6- and 7-figure settlements, including the largest settlements in DFEH history. She was also a senior appellate court attorney, a deputy attorney general with the Civil Rights Enforcement Section of California Department of Justice, a partner in DLA Piper's employment practice, and a 2-term commissioner and vice chair of the Fair Employment and Housing Commission. Phyllis has settled significant matters in her capacity as a mediator in the areas of employment, including discrimination, harassment, and retaliation, wage and hour, class actions, civil rights. The list goes on and on. And just to tell you, I've listened to a number of seminars that Phyllis has been the presenter on, and the depth of her knowledge really, I will tell you, is unequaled. So welcome, Phyllis, and thank you. We're going to be having a very interesting morning, and Phyllis is going to tell you what story she's chosen for this episode. Phyllis?
Well, thank you, Len. It's always a pleasure to be on your program. I'm delighted to be back. So this is a mysterious case of unexplained injuries, a missing jailhouse video, the plaintiff's own amnesia, denials from the government, and finger pointing between two sets of governmental entities. So this is what happened. On a Cinco de Mayo afternoon, a plaintiff and his cousin celebrated the day at a restaurant. They had a few drinks and they wanted to walk home. Well, they decided to take the shortcut and jaywalk. Because they were jaywalking, they were stopped by the police, and because they had been drinking, plaintiff was arrested for public intoxication and also for resisting arrest. So he was handcuffed, put into a police car, and taken to the city jail, which, by the way, was not staffed by the police, but staffed by a private contractor, jailers. Okay. So he was in a sobering cell, which is just a solitary small cell with a video camera the entire time. So he was there maybe a little bit less than 24 hours. Okay. So during that time, looking at the video, you see that the plaintiff at first was sleeping. Then he woke up, walked around a bit, decided that he'd exercise. He actually even took off his shirt. You could see his, you know, torso quite well. And he was, shadow boxing and doing yoga, swinging his arms, doing stretches, and even push-ups. So he did this for a while. And then the last video showed him rubbing his arm and complaining of pain throughout his arm and wanting to go to the hospital. So he was taken to the hospital, and at the hospital there were, examinations and x-rays and pictures taken, and it showed that his entire arm, one arm, was full of contusions, bright red, full of bruises and marks. And also, he was found to have a fractured wrist and a black eye. Now, none of this had been visible in the video when he first entered the cell. And the segment of the video immediately before he complained of the injury showed an empty room. So what happened? Did he hurt himself? Did somebody beat him up? Was it an X-File episode of some other extraterrestrial event that caused his injury? Well, he found a lawyer and they sued, alleging excessive force by the police and by the private jailers, and that they used excessive force to cause his injuries, denied him due process, and violated his constitutional rights.
So it looks like, unless aliens came down and mysteriously entered the jail cell, I'm talking about extraterrestrial types of aliens. The attorney decided not to go with that one. So let's go with somebody hurt him, because I'm not sure that doing yoga or any of that is going to cause typically black eyes and broken arms. So far it sounds like maybe they're reasonable in terms of how they're approaching this from the plaintiff's side.
Yes. Now, on the defense side, well, there are two sets of defendants, right? First, you have the police. And the police said, we didn't do anything. We arrested him. He seemed fine. He might have struggled with his handcuffs a little bit in the car. But when we brought him to jail, we were done. We weren't responsible. The only thing we did was turn on the videotape. And the private jailer said, we didn't do anything. We didn't arrest him. He was in the solitary cell. Nobody went in. So he must have, either the police had hurt him before or he had done this to himself. So the co-defendants basically said, the plaintiff just did this to himself. It's pretty hard to fracture your wrist and do push-ups. And it's pretty hard to give yourself a black eye and have contusions all over the arm.
So there's a lot of finger pointing going on here, and the private security firm that was running the jail, did they have, you mentioned the video. The video apparently didn't show everything.
No, they didn't. Now, I think an additional complication is that the plaintiff had amnesia. He himself could not remember what happened. The only evidence we have is his exercising in the cell, the final video showing his arm was hurt, and then a blank video showing nobody in the room. So when there was a discovery on producing the videos, what's interesting is that the segment immediately preceding his complaint of being injured, that segment was substituted by another segment. So instead of an AM, PM, for example, it was the same period of time, PM to AM, which of course totally different time period. And that's why the cell was empty.
Wow. You've described his injuries, but how was that? Did that affect his life? And, you know, how old is this guy, by the way?
This guy is probably in his mid to late 20s. Mm-hmm. He did have to have his arm in a cast. And of course, you know, he had some pain and suffering. But I don't know that he had any loss of wages or earnings. Certainly was just pain and suffering and the injury. And apparently he didn't require any surgery. But nonetheless, because there was a lawsuit, the opening demand was extremely high. And the defendant said, no, this is ridiculous. We don't admit to any liability. And of course, we would never agree to paying this sum. And also the co-defendants, one of them, the police said to the private jailers, if we're going to settle, you're going to have to pay the same proportion. And the private jailer said, no, it's more your fault than our fault, and we're not going to pay the same proportion. So that was a dynamic.
Well, it's interesting because given the facts that you've laid out, it appears that he was actually in the cell with no injuries from handcuffs. I mean, doing push-ups is hard enough, but doing push-ups with a broken wrist, it becomes a little even more difficult. So I'm surprised that the police offered anything at this point.
Oh, it was just a very small amount of nuisance value each side. I had to conduct the mediation in separate rooms. So the defendants were separated from one another so that they didn't want to know. If they weren't going to go in together and have the same proportion, then they didn't want to let the other defendant know what they were offering. The courts was offering the same demand to each side.
Okay. All right. So the alternative to resolving this case is trial, right? And so the idea of the risks, and the risks involved to the defendants, did you explore that before the mediation session with the attorneys or what?
Well, I always have a pre-mediation conference call with the counsel. During that time, we primarily talked about the logistics of the mediation, but each party submitted its own mediation brief with its own demand or offers. So I was able to see all that in advance, but because the co-defendants were the way they were about secrecy, I had to keep that private from the co-defendants, but plaintiffs knew, of course, what the counteroffers were.
Got it. Well, we're going to take a break now. And when we come back on the other side, we're going to be hearing about what happened at the actual mediation session and how Phyllis approached this to help reach a resolution. I'm Len Levy. This is Masters of Dispute Resolution, and my guest is Phyllis Chang.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and my guest is Phyllis Chang. And Phyllis has, in the first segment of this, really talked about an intriguing mystery. We really don't often get a chance to solve mysteries in the course of a mediation, but we're going to hear how Phyllis helped them this time. So, Phyllis, What happened at the mediation?
Well, what happened at the mediation was that everybody was denying, right? The plaintiff said, I can't remember anything. And the city says, we didn't do it. I mean, government said, I didn't do it. And the private jailer says, we didn't do it. It's the other people's fault. So I started using a very old doctrine called res ipsa locutor, which goes all the way back to Cicero and was developed under the king's court. And basically, it basically says, well, it wouldn't have happened. This wouldn't have happened without some kind of negligence. And the harm must have been caused by somebody who was in control of the situation. And finally, it couldn't have been the plaintiff himself voluntarily doing it. So it seemed to me this doctrine really applied in this case. So I asked him, well, clearly was in control of the police when he was arrested. He was under the control of the jailers when he was in the cell all that time. And the video was in charge, was under the control of the police. And also the production of the video was under the control of the police. And clearly, it's very difficult to give yourself a black eye or break your own wrist and still do push-ups. So, I mean, what else is there? What is a reasonable explanation? So I was able to get each side to consider that. Now, the case did not resolve at the mediation because they were too far apart. And the finger pointing was pretty strong. I did follow up with each side and talked about the risks involved. And with the plaintiff side, I said, you know what? They were filing a motion for spoliation of evidence because of the videotape that was missing. And each of the co-defendants have filed a motion for summary judgment saying, hey, you know, they can't prove that we did anything. So I said to them, don't you think a reasonable jury would think that something did happen and the plaintiff didn't do it to himself? So I was able to, through quite a lot of follow-up, to get the parties to agree to a settlement. There was a little bit of a wrinkle with one of the co-defendants. A junior attorney was working on the case, and although I had discussed potential mediation mediator's proposals with him and asked him to run it by his client, he actually hadn't done that. So by the time I issued the mediator's proposal, his client was surprised, even though it really was a very modest amount. So this junior attorney went behind the mediator's proposal and went directly to plaintiff's counsel. So the case almost blew up because plaintiff's counsel was so angry, first of all, that they could have rejected it. Second, he went behind the mediator to do this. Anyway, it took quite a lot of cajoling and persuasion and working with the supervising attorney in charge of this junior attorney to finally get them to agree to a global settlement. So the case happily resolved under a global settlement. We may never know the true reasons why this happened, but nonetheless, the case settled, and more likely than not, given that the thing speaks for itself.
Right.
You know, clearly the plaintiff didn't do it, so one of the co-defendants must have caused the injury.
So let's go back to the actual mediation session. You have everyone in private rooms. You've had private conversations with them. And this is kind of a takeaway too, but it appears that the client, and I'm not sure whether it was the client, police department, or the client, whatever the client was essentially a non-participant in the process. And was that client at the mediation?
No, it was on follow-up. All the clients were there, the plaintiff,
okay,
representatives from the police department, and representatives from the private jailer company. They were all there. But when I did follow-up, of course, I did that directly with counsel. So that was part of the problem. I had to rely on counsel to speak to their clients. And, you know, it's very difficult to control that process because that's their private conversation.
Right. In this instance, the attorney not keeping the client apprised as developments went on created a need for him to, or her, to essentially play catch up. It's like, wait a minute, how do we get from A to Z here? What was it that the attorney withheld from the client and should have told?
The attorney withheld all of the follow-up conversations I had with him. And I take very copious notes. So I had the dates, I had the language I used, I had the amount of a potential mediator's proposal that I wanted him to float with his client. Mm-hmm. And apparently he didn't discuss any of those things with his client or with his supervising attorney.
Wow. We're going to get into this a little bit more on takeaways, but the session itself, it doesn't sound like it fell apart. It's just that getting the parties to move did not occur to a significant enough degree. Did they move at all?
They did move, and I did quite a lot of bracketing. We had to do two sets of bracketing, right? One with the city, the government, and one with the private jailers. Also, another wrinkle is that in terms of plaintiff's counsel, there were three attorneys, and the primary attorney came into the mediation kind of late towards the end. So a lot of the negotiations, a lot of the work that we had done, she wasn't part of. So as a result, there was some retraction. They stepped back a little bit and made it a little bit more difficult to settle the case. So a lot of it is, you know, we cannot control if there's several attorneys who's going to be in the room at one time. Sometimes, you know, out of three attorneys, the one who actually was a decision maker wasn't in the room until later, towards the end of the mediation.
Right.
That's part of the problem. And the senior attorney who was in charge, really, of the junior attorney never engaged in the mediation or in the post-mediation follow-up, except when I contacted that person myself to let them know what had occurred.
Let me ask you this. Why did they decide to mediate?
They decided to mediate because there were many competing motions. There was a motion by plaintiff on spoliation of evidence. Each of the co-defendants had its own motion for summary judgment. The court was, and everything was due and would be heard the same day, and trial was coming up in a couple months.
So they had timing issues where they were going to have to spend a lot of money. They were and they were hoping to avoid all of that. But which party, if you know, suggested the mediation process?
I believe that it was plaintiff's counsel who suggested the mediation process. And I had mediated, I think, with all of the firms before, plaintiff's firm and each of the defendants' firms. We had worked together before.
So you had established a great degree of trust. You didn't have to essentially prove yourself to anyone in terms of how you handle things. They all knew that. It sounds like everybody just felt that, yeah, the law is on my side and the facts are on my side. It also seems that are you the one who sorted all this out and said, you know, you may think that the facts are on your side, but how about this?
Yes, I did. And I also asked each side, how much would it cost you if we did not settle the case to go forward? What are the risks of the court ruling one way or another on your pending motions? Mm-hmm. You know, the costs are building up, the risks are still high, and do you really want to do that? So if we can settle the case to mitigate the risk that you are actually realistically facing, isn't it worthwhile?
Right.
So that's what I had to persuade them with. But plaintiff's demand was still extremely high at the end of the mediation. I was able to persuade the lead attorney on the plaintiff's side to have a more modest, at least they would never come back with numbers that would have worked. I propose, I float a mediator's proposal with each side to say, can this work for you? This is the best I can do.
Right.
You live with that.
Right. Never mind the fact that each side said, well, I didn't do it. You know, the police didn't, I didn't do it. The private jailer, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. Was there any consensus at all as to what the overall risk or the overall potential recovery might be from the plaintiff, by the plaintiff, had the matter gone to trial?
I always ask plaintiff's counsel to please break out their opening demand to me so that I understand how they reached that number. That was never given to me. And I, understanding that there were no wage loss and that in terms of the medical treatment, I think the plaintiff was on Medi-Cal. So he actually had no out-of-pocket expenses. He had pain and suffering, for sure. But it's difficult to come up, given those injuries and given those out-of-pocket expenses, to a number that was as high as they were demanding. And of course, it really turned off the other sides because the defense thought, well, if it's going to cost that much, we might as well just roll the dice and let the court decide.
We're going to take another break and discuss some of the takeaways and some of the things that might have been done by counsel to help the process, some of the things that might have been done overall. We're going to be back in just a moment. I'm Len Levy. You're listening to Masters of Dispute Resolution, and we are having a great discussion with Phyllis Chang.
We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator or doing the work these experts are discussing? Are you thinking about it now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of our guests on the show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already and you're looking to add your toolbox and pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation. We train mediators of all levels. We're the place you want to come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator, because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a mediator in all kinds of settings. Find us at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse our selection of courses for streaming on demand. Or call us at 310-593-9906. Watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. Then we'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and I'm chatting with Phyllis Chang. You've already heard what happened at the mediation. You've already heard what happened to bring the parties to mediation. And now we're going to get into some of the things that Phyllis did that are just absolutely fascinating to me. They're really tools that people should pay attention to. So let's start out with one: valuation. How do you get what you've described as a high demand? How do you get the parties to get to a point where you can get them to agree or be able to put out a mediated proposal?
Well, when the parties are very far apart, usually after a couple rounds of using real offers and counteroffers, using real numbers, I encourage them to start bracketing. And so when we bracket, as you know, it's if you go to this number, we'll go to that number. So basically there's a range. For example, let's say there's a range of 100,000 to 800,000. And so the midpoint would be 450,000 on the plaintiff side. And let's say for one of the co-defendants, it was something like, I'm just making this up, 10,000 to 40,000. So the midpoint is 225,000. And then the third, let's say it's something like 20,000 to 40,000. So the midpoint is 30,000. I would look at their all the midpoints. I would also do the midpoint of the midpoint. So the plaintiff's midpoint as against defendant one, the plaintiff's midpoint as against defendant two. And I find that if you do several of them, a series of, sometimes I do even 20 of them. But let's say in this case, maybe we did three or four of them. You begin to see a trend. You begin to see the midpoint. The midpoints are going to hover around a general range. And it's going to be a much more reasonable number because one side is extremely high, the other one is low. But you still come to some kind of a picture of where the case could land. I don't actually value it. These are the party's own numbers. So at the end, even though the case did not settle, I was able to use this record with the party saying, look, at the end of the mediation, at the beginning of the mediation where you were this far apart, at the end of the mediation, the bracket showed a range from this to that. This is the midpoint of the midpoints. Now, let's see if we can settle the case within this, the midpoint of the midpoint. So I would float a mediator's proposal. That falls somewhere in there. I don't actually push for a particular number, but by that time, I'm able to kind of guess where each side might be able to stretch to reach a number. So I float those numbers with each side. Now, in this case, because we have two co-defendants who did not want to, who wanted to keep secret their negotiations from one another, actually, that was kind of helpful. I could say to one side, you know, the other side is, it's also, you're very lucky to have a co-defendant because otherwise, if you were the sole defendant, it would be that, you know, the numbers would be much higher. And to the one of the co-defendants, I would say, you know, the other side's paying much, much more than you. I can't tell you what it is, but, you know, I think you're doing well if you could settle at this number, that kind of thing. And then I need to talk to plaintiff's counsel for a global number that will work. Now, in this case, because one was a governmental entity, one of the co-defendants, and the other one was a private entity, the private entity really wanted to keep that confidential. So I respected that. I ensured that their concerns were addressed, and same with the public sector and the plaintiff's side. So that's really how we kind of reach consensus. And I also find that it's very helpful to have the clients there at the mediation. They need to hear this. They need to participate. However, I think on follow-up, it's also very helpful to not have the client there because the counsel don't have to posture to their clients to say, I'm really a tough attorney and I'm not giving in. And I said to them, you can always blame me, the mediator, for coming up with these numbers. Right. And it's a consensus. It's you know, it's a settlement and everyone needs to stretch. So I was able to talk to them that way. And it took quite a while to come up with a solution at the end, you know, and then plus we had that extra little problem, which was finally resolved.
One of the things that it seems, I mean, there are a lot of things going down around here, and we could teach a whole course in it on bracketing and things of that nature. But one of the things that's going on here, when you were just mentioned, keeping the client in the loop as opposed to the client being present, because what I found, there are two things that I've found lately. One is that I will get a bracket, but attorneys may say to me, well, don't read the midpoint of the midpoint because we really don't want to go there. And so it's like, okay, well, I've got to be somewhere here. And the other thing is, if a client hears a particular number being offered or being demanded by, depending on what side they're on, and there's a jump because that client is not being kept in the loop by the attorney on the process, then what happens is the client has this sense of, well, I demanded $1 million, right? And now I'm willing to, now you want me to settle for $300,000? I've just lost $700,000 in this mediation. So there's this bias that exists that sense of loss. You're essentially, Phyllis, you're leading an orchestra here. That's what you're doing. You're leading an orchestra and making sure that everyone is playing on the same time and with the same notes and in the same key starts to become a real challenge, and it can be made worse if clients are not kept apprised. There are other things I think that you had alluded to that they didn't do that should have been done.
Yes, I think that it's really critical for lawyers going into a mediation. For the plaintiff side, it's really important to kind of level with your mediator and trust your mediator, because that's going to make it easier. I mean, most of the time we're in the dark ourselves, right? Kind of finding our way to see what may or may not work. But it really is important to break out your demands so that you give the mediator as much ammunition as possible to go in and say, this is what they're asking for and this is why. These are the numbers. And I often do that when that's given to me. That's extremely helpful. It's important for the parties to be there, the lead attorneys who are going to make the decisions and recommendations to the clients, to be there at the mediation. Don't just assign it to somebody more less senior who may not have the relationship with the client, who may not be experienced enough to negotiate. Stay with it. And for the defense counsel, you know, it also is important at some point, maybe not at the very beginning of the mediation, to kind of have a little more transparency with the mediator. When the mediator understands why you are coming with a counter a certain way and what your limitations are. And sometimes there are limitations, you know, insurance or, you know, a certain kind of culture at the company that may put restrictions on what they can settle for. That's also important. Finally, being creative. I always try to have as creative a solution as possible. If we cannot do it, all of it with money, what can we do to also make the value of the settlement worthwhile, particularly to the plaintiff? So when I do employment discrimination, employment cases, I often look at things like, can the employee submit a letter of resignation if the person had been terminated? Just put it in the person's file so they can honestly say to future employers, I resign. Another thing is taxation. Can we limit the taxable wages so that the plaintiff gets more in his or her pocket? Sometimes, you know, particularly employment cases, it's their outsourced placement. So outplacement services, for example, do they normally help their, say, laid off employees with resume writing, with interview skills, with job search, that kind of thing? There are many, many things we can do. On the defense side, sometimes people can't pay it all at once. Can we have a payment plan? Can we have, you know, some things can be confidential. Can we keep this confidential, for example? There are things we can do on each end, but all of that requires a lot of trust with the mediation and having some transparency, because what we want as mediators is to satisfy as much as possible every side's concerns. We can't be miracle workers, but we can make the settlement something that each side can live with and feel that it was a fair process.
Well, in this particular instance, and what you've described here is essentially creating value. You create value, like with the various outsourcing provisions. You actually, there's a term called cost cutting, where the cost to the employer may be diminished by the fact that there is a confidentiality agreement. So there are a lot of things that you do, I know. That you have to look for, but it also starts with your being able to advocate for example, with a plaintiff's case, you need to be able to say, well, look, the demand is this, and the justification is A, B, C, X, Y, and Z. That gives a credibility factor, not just for you, but a credibility factor for the plaintiff's attorney, for example, where it's not just a number that's pulled out of the, you know, out of, well, I won't go there, but it's going to be a number that has some justification. Yeah. And look, as we've discussed a number of times, coming up with a number is, you know, reminds me of my old torts professor who became a judge, Fred Lauer, who said, just about the first day of the torts class, translating pain and suffering into money is one of the most difficult things you can do. I mean, yes, occasionally there are verdicts, but I've got to tell you, in a case like this, I don't know what verdicts would possibly be useful to persuade anyone. Unless there's some verdict and you could possibly Google aliens, aliens entering jail cells or things of that nature. But anyway, Phyllis, thank you very, very much. Do you have any other comments you would like to add now before we break?
You know, even X-Files can be resolved if you apply some, you know, very common legal doctrines and you have a good rapport with the parties.
Right, right. Thank you very, very much, Phyllis. This has been just an absolute pleasure, as is always the case with you. And I would like to thank also my engineer, Daryl Wayne. I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Invigen Labs, Inc. I will continue to hope that everyone enjoys all of the stories that we bring you. And in the meantime, until we meet again, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.